Warm welcome, Netta Bob S.
Well, I certainly would be remiss if I didn't thank the committee for putting this together. I realize that these things don't just happen. It takes a lot of work by a lot of people, and I want to thank Pat and Steve and Jim, who's been my chauffeur, and all of those of you who have shared even your home with me since I've been here. I am truly, truly grateful to you. Well, first, I guess I better tell you my name is Bob Smith, and I'm an enthusiastic Al-Anon. I got here just like the rest of you, I think. I'm here because I love an alcoholic. My wife, Betty, my bride, to whom I've been married 42 years, has got 8 years sobriety this month, and believe you me, for that I am truly grateful. A couple days ago, we were digging around trimming the bushes back at home. We had some Fitz juniper that were heavy, you know, and guess what? We came across a gallon of wine. Half empty. Well aged. She forgot where she hid it, and I didn't know she hid it. So I think you all will relate to that. I do four things myself as an Al-Anon, and I'd like to pass those on to you. I try to work the 12 steps to the best of my ability. I abide by the 12 traditions of Al-Anon. I attend meetings regularly, and I have a sponsor. Now, my sponsor is a woman, and that's not recommended, and I understand why, because, you know, male and female have different wants and needs. But when I first came into Al-Anon, the only male was a young guy about the age of my son, and I didn't think we had too much going. So I asked this lady to be my sponsor, and she said, well, I've never have sponsored a man, but I'll try it, and if I don't like it, I'll let you know. And she's been my sponsor ever since, and I'd like to tell you that she is one of those conference-approved Al-Anons. And let me pass this on to you, too. You know, you can tell by looking at me that this sex thing doesn't loom nearly as large on the horizon as it used to. You know, don't misunderstand me. I just love to see you beautiful ladies. But I can't remember why. You know, I noticed when Pat made the introductions, there are a lot of you involved in service, and I think that too is part of our program. Those of you, or those of us who really want to try and get it all. I've been the GR, and I've been the DR, and I was put in 3 years as treasurer of the West Texas Assembly. Texas is divided into two assemblies because it's so big geographically. Texas is my home, in case you didn't know. And a couple years ago, maybe it's less than that now, I guess over a year ago, the World Service Office wrote and asked if I would consider being the trustee at large. And I prayed about that, and I thought, boy, that'd be great. So I wrote in and said I would be considered, you know, consider me for the nomination for trustee at large. And you know what? I didn't get it. And I had a resentment at first, but my program came to my rescue, and I realized that whoever got it probably was infinitely more capable than I. And I also realized this, that my Heavenly Father gives me just what I need, not what I want, but just what I need to get along. And also I realize that He does this so that I won't look too good. Okay, He keeps me from looking good. You know, I'm somewhat of an anachronism because even though I've only been in Al-Anon for 8 years, I'm the only one still living that was present when the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous met for the first time at the home of Henrietta Seiberling on Mother's Day in Akron, Ohio in 1935. You see, I rode out with my father and mother to meet with Bill W. for that first meeting that is considered the founding date of AA. My father's Dr. Bob and my mother's Ann. And since the theme of this meeting is as such it is, I'd like to take you back with me. I'd like to take half the time that you've allotted to me and take you back in my memory to those times to kind of show you how what I consider a series of miracles have happened to come from that time to this. Now, I was a teenager at a time. I was 16 years old when I rode out with them that day. I may not fit your role model, but I think my sister and I are probably the original Alateens. But I was old enough to know what was going on. And my father had come home on Saturday with a potted plant for Mother's Day. He was potted. Set it down, and as was his habit, he went upstairs and passed out in the bed. Mrs. Seiberling called my mother, Ann, who was her friend, and said, "Ann, there's a man out here at my home that I believe could help Bob. Will you come?" And my mother had to explain to Henrietta Seiberling that she couldn't come that day, that Bob was in no shape to talk to anybody, but that she would get him to come Sunday. So my father had a terrible hangover, but when Mother turned the heat on him, why, he said, "Okay, 15 minutes of this guy, that's all I want." And they rode out there, and it wasn't 15 minutes. They stayed many hours, and as a result of that meeting, and at my mother's request, Bill W. came and lived at our home for 3 months, and this is the time that the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous were started. Now, I'd like to take you back in my memory, tell you a little bit about the times and the situation that was there at when it first started. It's such an unlikely story. In the first place, it was in the midst of the last Great Depression, and in 1935, we lived in a one-industry town, Akron, Ohio, and the rubber factories were all there, tire manufacturers, Goodyear, Goodrich, General, Firestone, Seiberling. They were all there except U.S. Royal. And when people stopped buying automobiles, they quit using tires. And that town just fell flat on its face financially. There were strong men on the street corner selling apples for 5 cents apiece. And in this home in which we lived, alcoholism and the times had reduced us to a stage of absolute poverty. We lived in a very modest frame home. And we would have lost that if it hadn't been for the mortgage moratorium declared by President Roosevelt in 1933, whereby people like us who could no longer make the mortgage payments were allowed to stay in the homes and not be thrown out in the street. I think I can describe this modest home to those of you who haven't seen it in terms you will understand. It looked a lot like Archie Bunker's house. So you see, it was no mansion. But it has been taken over now by a nonprofit organization called Founders Foundation, who are restoring this home. And I happened to be in Akron in 1985 when Governor Celeste of Ohio told his people to hand carry the papers through the state legislature to declare that place a state historic site. And then later on, it was carried to our federal government by the congressman from that 16th district of the state of Ohio, and he helped it get through, and it is now on the National Register of Historic Sites. And guess who that guy is? Been the congressman for 16 years. John Seiberling, the son of Henrietta Seiberling. Well, I'm glad that they did it because after my folks died, my sister had sold the house, and it was a rent house. And there were people that liked to come to Founders Day in Akron, and they liked to tour. You know, they take them around to the various places that were of historic interest, and I'll talk about some of them, and to see where AA started. And they would take them by this house on Ardmore Avenue, and it was rented to a bunch of hippies. And they were out in the front yard drinking beer and flipping everybody a bird that came by. Some of you older people may not know what flipping a bird is. I had asked my son. But anyway, that house is now being preserved, and I was privileged to be back there in 85 for the first time since my father's death. And it's just what brought back so many memories to me. And it's clean. The rooms are a lot smaller than I remembered. But it's clean, and it's been kept in the simplicity. I think that's what strikes people most that go in that house, is the simplicity of it. And maybe that was intended by a higher power, too, because after all, it's the simplicity of this program, I think, that allows us to receive it when we need it the most. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my father, Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob was a Vermonter. He was a tall, thin Yankee with icy blue eyes, and he had graduated from Dartmouth, one of the Ivy League colleges, the drinkers college of the group, and had worked out in industry for a couple of years. He worked in Filings Department Store, and he worked for Fairbanks Morse. And he came back to St. Johnsbury, Vermont, his home, and prevailed upon his father, who was the probate judge of that district, to send him through medical school. And he went on to Chicago and managed to barely get through medical school because, you see, his alcoholism was progressing all the time. And he managed somehow to obtain a coveted internship at City Hospital in Akron. It was coveted because they had some advanced equipment at the time. So he moved to Akron, and he married my mother after a whirlwind courtship of only 17 years. Dr. Bob thought things over very carefully. Now, Bill W., you know, was also a Vermonter. They were born within 100 miles of each other, and he was also tall and thin. But these two guys were just exactly the opposite. Bill was garrulous. He loved people. He loved to talk to people. His mood swung high, and they dipped down low. He was a promoter. Bill was a visionary. Bill could see further up the road than any human I believe I've ever known. And Dr. Bob was the exact opposite. He was steady and unchanging, thoughtful. And these two guys fit together perfectly. They never had an argument. And I think that that, again, was arranged by a higher power. Because, you know, if any two of us are exactly alike, one of us is unnecessary. Dr. Bob also had a beautiful sense of humor. When I brought my bride-to-be home, she's tall and thin, and he got me aside and said she's built for speed and light housekeeping. And as I told you, he didn't say very many words, but he thought things over very carefully. And I don't think I'll offend any of you. I want to tell you about his sex and hygiene lecture to me as a teenager. He got me up in the bathroom and closed the door like fathers do, you know. And I thought, hot dog, I'm going to find out all about it now. And he looked at me and he said, flies spread disease. Keep yours buttoned. Now I'd like to tell you a little bit about my mother, Anne, who was so important to this movement. My mother was a graduate of Wellesley College, one of the fine women's colleges back in the East, and she went there on a scholarship, and she was no dummy. And her great uncle was president of the Santa Fe Railroad. And as a young lady, he took a shine to her, and he would take her around the country in his private railroad cars. You know, in those days, the president of the railroad had their own sumptuous railroad car, and they could tie on to anybody's railroad line and go wherever railroads went in the U.S. or Canada. And so he took her around the country, and she got to see the gracious living. And she had led a very protected, sheltered life, and was very easily shocked until AA. But this lady, and I'm going to get into it a little bit further, was so important to getting this thing off the ground. Now, when Bill came to live with us, my mother wrote to Lois, our co-founder. And Lois came down. Lois caught the bus down from New York City, came down to Akron, and she was with us for a while. And we got to know her very well, and that's a friendship that I still have with Lois. Lovely, lovely person. But after a while, Lois had to go back to New York. And you got to understand, Lois is the only one with a job. Can you imagine? So Bill and Dr. Bob thought, well, now what we need to do is find another alcoholic. They had the idea of service, and they had an open spiritual mind. I think these two things are part of the miracle that unfolded, that they both had this idea of service, and they both kept an open spiritual mind. So there was a young guy by the name of Eddie R. who had just been thrown out in the street along with his cute little blonde wife and two kids for non-payment of rent. So they moved the whole bunch in our house, and Bill and Dr. Bob began to work on this prospect. Now they locked Eddie upstairs in the bedroom where he'd be available, you know, as they got this. But Eddie was an agile guy, and we had downspouts. And Eddie would open the second story window, slide down the downspouts and escape, and they'd have to postpone the program until they could recapture Eddie. One time he got as far as Cleveland, Ohio, 35 miles away. Yeah. Called him up on the phone, collect, to let them know that he was going to commit suicide, but that he would give them time to get there to witness the event. Well, they drove up to Cleveland and rescued Eddie and brought him back home and got Eddie sobered up. But when Eddie sobered up, some other little problems began to emerge. Eddie started chasing my mother around the house with a butcher knife, and she feared for her life, and he was also beating on this little wife. And it was finally decided that the thing to do with Eddie was for his wife to take him back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and recommit him in a mental institution. And this was done, and Bill and Dr. Bob were absolutely crestfallen. The first attempt, total failure. But I want to tell you something. At my father's funeral in 1950, a man came up to me and he said, "Do you know me?" And I said, "Yeah, I know you. You're Eddie." And he said, "That's right." He said, "And I'm a member of the Youngstown, Ohio AA group, and I've been sober 1 year." And I tell you this because I'm sure that you, like me, have made a 12-step call and thought you had absolutely no impression whatsoever, made no impression whatsoever on the person, that it just, they weren't interested or went in one ear and out the other. But you never know. Think about Eddie. You know, we're not called on for the results. All we're called on to do is take the action. And I talked to Eddie's lady, had been Eddie's secretary in Akron in 85, and she said Eddie never took another drink as long as he lived. Stayed sober. Eddie's dead now. So when you think about if you're a little discouraged in your 12-step work, remember Eddie. Well, You know, there was no money then. Everybody was terribly, terribly broke. Hospitals were very expensive. A room was like $16 a day. I think they're up some now, but you know, it didn't make any difference if you didn't have the 16 bucks. So they hit on the idea of bringing them into our modest home. And Dr. Bob, being the only medical man associated with the movement at the time, would treat them medically. And then they would take the recovery from there. Well, here's what they did. They would take them upstairs in the bedroom, and Dr. Bob would say, now I'm going to give you this shot of whiskey, but I want you to take this little bit of medicine first. And it was peraldehyde. And they really knocked him out from 24 to 36 hours. You know, the guy was gone. And when he came to, they brought him downstairs. And in the kitchen, they started on the health foods to bring back the physical strength, you know, and well-being. And here's the diet. It was canned tomatoes, sauerkraut. Bill had an ulcer, and he thought sauerkraut cured everything. And K-Ro syrup. Now, I think you'll all have to agree that the early alcoholics were a hardy group. But remember now, there's nothing written. They're just flying by the seat of their pants and stumbling along the best they could, hoping that they could get this going. And it was just a trickle at first. It was just word of mouth. Now, the early AAs were low-bottom drunks. There weren't any young people in there like there are now. And I say, thank goodness these young people are coming in. It just tickles me to death to see you young people that are coming into the program as soon as you are now. But the early ones were not that way. They were low-bottom drunks. They were usually middle-aged men. There was one woman that came along fairly early in the program, but they caught her doing a little 13th-step work on Dr. Bob's examining table with one of the early AAs. So the wives and sweethearts just went straight up in smoke over that one, and it was decided that maybe they should stick to the men for the time being. And I think that lady single-handedly set back the ladies' cause for a couple of years. But all the time that this thing is coming on now, you've got to realize no money, no particular guidance. They had a little help from an organization called the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group had nothing to do with Oxford, England. It was started by a Lutheran minister from Pennsylvania. But it had some things that helped our programs, I think, and has served us well. They had four absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity of thought, and absolute love that Bill and Dr. Bob used, because they both had been members of this thing, Bill for 6 months and Dr. Bob for 2.5 years. And they also had a form of a fifth step. And I used to go to some of those Oxford Group meetings at the home of T. Henry Williams, and they would, if they got a new guy, they would take him upstairs, and about four or five of these guys would bore in on him and find out what his problem was, you know, and make him confess. And they must have really worked him over, because I can still see him in my mind's eye. You know, they're kind of white and shaken when they came down. But you see, it was inevitable that they separate, because that sort of a thing was not acceptable to the Catholic religion. It was open confession. Also, the Oxford Group catered to the upper middle class. And believe you me, the early drunks weren't upper middle class. The Oxford Group wanted publicity. And the alcoholics had all the publicity they wanted before they got there. So anyway, even though we owe those people a terrific debt, it was inevitable that they separate. My mother was the one that called the wives and the sweethearts daily of these early alcoholics, because she recognized that this disease affected the whole family. And I've got a letter here, and I'd like to excerpt it, and I'll tell you what it is so you'll understand. This letter was written by Henrietta Dodson, and I don't break Henrietta's anonymity because she's gone now. It's different from Henrietta Cyberling. I don't want to confuse you. But Henrietta Dodson is the wife of the first successful AA, Bill D, that's in our big book. And she wrote this letter to Bill W. It said, on Friday, June 28th, 1935, I met Ann Smith. I met Dr. Bob on Thursday morning in the hospital. On Thursday evening when I went to the hospital to see my husband, Dr. Bob was there, and he said, the little woman would like you to come over to the house. I told him I could not go that night, but would go the next night. On Friday night when I went to the house on Ardmore Avenue, I met the most thoughtful, understanding person I've ever known. After talking with her for a while, I addressed her as Mrs. Smith, and she said, Ann, to you, my dear. She wanted to remove all barriers. Bill W. was there at the time, and I skip a little bit. Ann told me to surrender myself to God and ask him if he had a plan for me, to reveal it to me. Ann taught me to have a quiet time in the morning that I might feel near to God and receive strength for the day. She taught me to surrender my husband to God and not to try and tell him how to stay sober, as I'd tried that and failed. Ann taught me to love everyone. She said, ask yourself what is wrong with me today if I don't love you. She said, the love of God is triangular. It must flow from God, through me, through you, and back to God. She told me I should never criticize the person leading the meeting, as we do not know what God's plan. Maybe what that person says will meet the need of someone in the group. In the early part of 1936, Ann organized a woman's group for wives of alcoholics, whereby in her loving way, she tried to teach us patience, love, and unselfishness. Ann made it very clear to me in the beginning that she wanted no credit for herself. It was God. All she wanted was to keep herself so that she could know and follow God's plan. When I met and talked with this intelligent, deeply spiritual woman, I was completely sold on AA, Henrietta Dodson. So you see, the need was there. It was recognized from the start as being a family thing. And it, thank goodness, our co-founder Lois saw fit and had the ability and the help to put it into a program like we can use today. I want you to know that both these movements were not easy. It was hard fought from the word go. A lot of people did a lot of hard work, and they're still doing it, I might add. But you see, a lot of people thought this was a cult. AA was a cult when it started, or that they were a bunch of nuts. And there was scorn and ridicule. And my mother endured all that. And you understand, this is the lady that's making the beds and cleaning up the messes and doing the cooking and counseling on the telephone and doing all these things. Bill Wilson himself said, Ann Smith is the mother of AA, and I believe that. I think that perhaps if it hadn't been for Ann, my mother, that Bill and Dr. Bob might have quit. But she never lost faith in them. We even got kicked out of the Presbyterian Church on account of AA. Now, I never heard of anybody being kicked out of the Presbyterian Church, but we were. The minister asked us to leave as a family. That was the reputation that AA had. And all the while, this thing's building. And of course, when the media got a hold of it, it started really rolling then. First the Cleveland Plain Dealer article, then Jack Alexander's article. And so they started coming into Akron on the thumb, walking, on bus, dumped off by loving relatives. Dumped off by non-loving relatives. Because the word had gotten around. that there was a doctor in Akron, Ohio, could, quote, fix drunks. And as another miracle at the time showed up in the person of Sister Ignatia, who was the admitting nurse, St. Thomas Hospital. Dr. Bob was on the staff there. And they prevailed upon the management of that Catholic hospital to start an alcoholic ward whereby alcoholics could be admitted with the disease of alcoholism for the first time. And you know that ward is still there? It's bigger than it was, and it's not on the same floor, but it's still going. My mother did this in spite of the fact that she had what I call a thorn, like the Paul in the Bible. She was gradually losing her sight, and nothing could be done about it. She could recognize that you know, you were sitting there, but she wouldn't know who it was until she heard your voice. But still, even with this handicap, she kept right on going up until the time she passed away. And my father, of course, was... I went to the First International, Betty and I, with my father. He was terminally ill at the time, and we drove him back to his beloved Vermont for the last time. And it was a poignant time when of sharing, and one that I'll never forget. I brought him back to Akron, and Betty and I caught a plane. I had a flying job out of Dallas at the time, so, and I never saw my father alive again. I got to go to the second international in 1955, where Bill turned AA over to the alcoholics, and that was the meeting when some of the great spiritual helpers that we had, another miracle, help us, like Father Ed Dowling, Dr. Sam Shoemaker, were there and talked, and we got to hear them. And I didn't go again until it became necessary for my wife and I to join the program. We went fresh, new into the program, went to the International in 80, and then we were privileged to go in Montreal in 1985, and I met some of you people there. What a meeting. 47,000 drunks all standing up, that. Tens of thousands of Al-Anons. You know, the headquarters for Joseph Seagram and Sons is in Montreal, and they have on one of the main streets, and those people love flags. And all the time that convention was there, that they flew the flags at half-mast. You know, when you stop and think of the miracles of our program that have happened, things that could have absolutely destroyed it. For instance, in the early days, there were people with big egos. Now, I know we don't have any of that now. But you know what took care of that? Anonymity. You can't be Mrs. Al-Anon if nobody knows what your name is, right? Anonymity. And that puts every one of us in exactly the same plane. It doesn't make any difference if you've been here 40 minutes or 40 years. We're all the same. Anonymity. It resisted the urge for money, which could have destroyed it. And believe me, Bill and Dr. Bob thought it'd be great, you know, to have money to really get going in a good shape. But Mr. Rockefeller, in his wisdom, said, no, money will ruin it. Another miracle, because these were desperate men in desperate times. AA and Al-Anon don't own any property, don't want to own any property. And I think that is providentially arranged, because it doesn't dilute our mission. We are not custodians of valuable real estate. We just have one purpose. God as we understand him. That was put in there in the steps to shut up a loudmouth agnostic by the name of Jimmy B. Jimmy said this God stuff will ruin it. So they thought, well, what they could do was to pacify Jimmy. They put in God as we understand him. And you know what that's done? That's allowed this movement to go into the Eastern religions. All over the world. You know, the sun never sets on AA now. most of us are Christian or Jewish or some denomination as such. But you know, folks, we're the minority in this world. But those three words put in there to shut up a loudmouth guy has allowed this to go on into other religions that are entirely different from ours. Another miracle. Well, I was raised in this home. My father drank, you know, for the first 17 years of my life. And it was a dysfunctional family. And I guess I reacted like anyone that's in that situation. I stayed away as much as I could. But I've learned subsequently that what happens to us, whether we're raised in an alcoholic family or whether we were somehow involved, married an alcoholic or whatever, is that we finally get to where we have trouble realizing what normal is. You know, if you've never seen normal, how do you know what it is? We just kind of surmise or take a guess at what normal is. And I think that's one of the things that makes us, if we were raised in that type of situation, makes it so easy for us to marry an alcoholic. Because it may be bizarre to somebody, kid, but it's normal to us. But anyway, I wanted to pass that on to you. And the one thing I think that I have used that information as a plus, because I added to the sum of my knowledge, because I don't intend to remain forever frozen in the role of an injured adolescent. Okay? I don't think we're called on to do that. And I think that the information that we're getting and have will lift us out of that. Well, my wife and I, while all this was going on, we liked to party and, you know, we liked to drink, and we went out and we did this many years. And my wife wasn't an instant alcoholic. She persevered. And somehow, somewhere along the line, she crossed that invisible line where she could no longer control her alcoholism. As she said, I was oftentimes drinking against my will. And she could not stop. I never asked Betty to stop drinking. I just asked her to quit getting so damn drunk, you know, and I'm sure you've done this. I'd say, now, okay, we're going to a party tonight. You take two drinks. And she would agree. And I would watch her like a flute player watching a cobra. She'd take two drinks, and man, she'd be loaded. Well, what I didn't know was while I was working that day, she was getting primed for the party. And I know all of us understand that. Well, Betty finally got to the point where she went into AA. She did it white-knuckled without a treatment center. It was very, very difficult for her. And she started changing. And she started showing signs of some things that I got interested in, that I wanted to kind of know about. So somebody said to me, well, why don't you go to Al-Anon? Well, you know, I didn't have perhaps a barrier that some of you had. I knew that the alcoholics were great people when sober. So that wasn't a big barrier for me. So I thought, well, why not? I don't mind joining the auxiliary. So I got in the car and I drove over to Gainesville, Texas, and I marched into my first Al-Anon meeting. You know, maybe a few character defects, just nothing that couldn't be straightened up in a week or so. The rock that had been holding this family together was absolutely noble. Just enough knowledge about alcoholism to be absolutely dangerous. And I look around and I'm the only man. Well, I began to get mixed emotions about the program right off from the start. And mixed emotions is kind of like when your teenage daughter comes in at 4 a.m. with a Gideon Bible under her arm. mm-hmm. But thank goodness for those ladies. They realized that we had a common problem and a common solution, and they allowed me to make my mistakes and allowed me to pop off and finally try to change. You know, I had to unlearn before I started learning, and you know, all of you know this. I'm sure you've gone through the same thing, but bless their hearts. And when I go back to that group, I still have that intimate feeling that I have for those ladies when I first went there 8 years ago. That feeling has never left me. I want to pass on to you some of the things that have been helpful to me in the program and that my father and mother taught me. You know, my father and mother took me around to all the churches there in Akron. We went to the Catholic masses and the Jewish synagogue and the various Protestant denominations. My father was a surgeon, you know. He even took us around to hear the Bible as interpreted by Mary Baker Eddy, the Christian Scientist who don't believe in doctors. But that was the kind of a mind he had. We had the Bible of the world at our house, and he tried to interest me in that. And I guess what he was trying to tell me was perhaps the God that I was able to understand was the God for me. And that was a big plus for me, because I don't know about y'all, but when I was a youngster, I didn't go to church. I was sent to church. You know, when you're in an alcoholic home, they don't take you, they send you. And God was used to improve my deportment. You know, if I did such and such, God was going to do such and such. And that, to me, was never acceptable, and I'm speaking only for myself now. I needed a loving, caring God, and I didn't find it till I got here. I learned perseverance from my mother, who never lost hope. I learned humility from my father. You got to understand that people absolutely were willing to worship that man. You got to realize that for the first time there was hope for the alcoholic. He wasn't going to go crazy or die. And you talk about grateful. Those people were really grateful. And he was a lovable guy anyway. People just loved him anyway. But he never let them lay that one on him. He said, I've only been used as an agent. And that turned off all that. Dr. Bob had trouble loving his fellow man. Can you believe this? He said, I didn't dislike him. He said, I might put a few coins in the dish. He said, I might go out of my way a little bit to help him if it didn't involve too much effort. Said it wouldn't hurt him, but he said to love him, he said, I just couldn't do it. But he learned to do it, and that was a help to me. I thought perhaps I was shallow, but there wasn't much to my personality because I didn't seem to have that ability that some of you have for that deep, deep love. But I found out that love is a learned phenomenon. You're not born with it. What you've got, somebody has given to you, and you accept it. Now, my folks gave me all the love that anybody would ever want, but I would only accept so much, and then I stop. But it isn't until I got here that I learned to accept the love that was offered. Yes, and I learned that I should study it to learn something about it. And I also learned that if I give it away, I've still got every bit I had. Fantastic. And that didn't come to me till I got here. And I still don't have that unconditional love, you know, that we talk about. That's a tough one for me. It's easy to love someone when they're all dressed up and cute and smiling, but it sure does strain you a little bit when they're throwing up on you. Bad-mouthing you. But anyway, I'm working on it. And our life is so much better now. It's just fantastic. We have a good relationship. You know, we even put carpet in our bathroom the other day. Yeah. And it is so nice We're thinking about running it on into the house. But what keeps me coming back is the attraction. The attraction is still there. I'm still enthusiastic about, I'm still excited about this movement. And I tell you, when you take a newcomer to your first meeting, you can't help but get excited. You know, when you see those eyes that were so, that terrible despair that all of us have known, change and begin to brighten up, you know, and begin to show a little interest. Now that's, if you can't be excited then, folks, you cannot be excited. But anyway, the attraction for me is it's allowing me to be more comfortable in my particular life situation and less stressful. And it also is giving me more personal self-awareness, which I didn't have too much of. I'm learning more about myself. And I find that in this program I have less emotional turbulence that used to just keep me torn up all the time. I find that this attraction in this program is that I am able to understand and participate in real intimacy with my fellow man. And I also find that I have less loneliness. It's the end of loneliness. Now these are the attractions that I have in my program. Our life isn't perfect. You know, I hear about AA's going on dry drunks. Well, I think us Al-Anons go on dry dries. You know, I think what happens is it's if we neglect our program, it's pretty easy for us to slip back into this abnormal situation that was so normal with us. In fact, I just had to apologize to my wife yesterday for a good dry that I had pulled. But at least I can recognize it, you know, when it's happening, and I can make that amend, and then we can go on about our life. I think our relationships have to be not 50-50, but 60-40, because we're human beings. We got to give each other a little slack. We had a pact. We got four children early on, and I'll pass this on to you, that whoever left first got the kids. That'll see you through some rough ones. I had an experience the other day. I had a buddy, an Al-Anon, a male Al-Anon, and Ray, I thought, had it all together. Boy, I just looked up to his program. He was so far ahead of me that it was an inspiration to me. But you know what? All of a sudden, Ray stopped, and he reverted back to the guy that he said he was. And I know it's tough on Ray, and it was hard for me to see, but maybe my higher power has brought that to my attention to show me what happens if I'm going to start backsliding. That I must, if I want this thing, if I want what I've got now, I've got to keep working at it. So you see, I've told you the things that have unfolded for AA. I've tried to show you how some of it unfolded for Al-Anon, and I've tried to tell you about the miracles that are unfolding in my life as a result of this wonderful Al-Anon program. And I would say to everyone here, don't you quit before your miracles. Don't quit before your miracle. Thank you very much.